Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. In the decades after the Civil War, the nation was changing rapidly. Cities were industrializing, the railroad was expanding, business was booming in many places, the stock ticker was about to go live. People were busy. At the time, there was a widespread belief that our bodies and minds ran on, quote, nervous energy, and that was a good thing.
In the late 19th century, nervous energy was something that you wanted to possess. It was nerve energy. It was what made us vital.
That's Purdue University history professor David Schuster. He says since people were working so hard in this new busy world, there was soon a fear that their nervous energy was getting drained.
And that could cause migraine headaches, that could cause insomnia, that could cause grown men to cry. It could affect the bowels, which would cause indigestion.
And the condition soon got a name, neurasthenia. David wrote a book about it. It's called Neurasthenic Nation.
If you had neurasthenia, the subtext was that you were working hard at something and you basically worked yourself into sickness and that you need to recover so that you can go back to work. So if people suffered from neurasthenia, it was a badge of honor, but it also was an excuse to take some time off so that you can recuperate to get back into the rat race.
This was very common. Teddy Roosevelt was diagnosed with it. One of the classic cures for this condition?
Go out west and rediscover your cowboy roots. Kind of embrace a manly life with the understanding that living close to nature in a rough and tumble world would help restore your body's vitality.
All right, this sounds kind of silly now, right? We would probably call neurasthenia anxiety or burnout. But think about what was happening. People were reacting to drastic changes in society, changes in lifestyle. They were trying to put their finger on an issue, and they were trying to solve it. That happens all the time. With new innovations and developments come new issues that we have to understand and address. Since we're entering into a new decade, on today's episode, we're looking at some of the new problems of our times and what's being done to address them. First up, when something that was touted as a solution becomes its own problem. I'm talking about vaping. A lot of smokers turn to vaping as a way to kick the habit. Vaping delivers a hit of nicotine, seemingly without many of the harmful chemicals that are in tobacco. But then we started hearing about a mysterious lung disease that put over 2,000 people in the hospital and killed more than 50. Since then, there's been a slew of new proposals to legislate vaping, from age restrictions to full-blown bans. So if you switched from smoking to vaping and aren't ready to quit cold turkey, what does this mean for you? Pulse reporter Liz Tung found herself in that situation, and she decided to investigate her options.
I had my first cigarette when I was 15. For years, I kept promising myself I'd quit. I tried, and I failed. And then last summer, I suddenly realized I've been smoking for almost 20 years. That was a number that really freaked me out. I'd tried nicotine gum, the patch, quitting cold turkey. Nothing worked. And then, finally, I found my savior, and it tasted like mango. I'm talking about Juul, the USB-looking e-cigarette that's super popular with teens. In less than a week, I had totally transitioned over from smoking to vaping, and I was feeling pretty good about myself. It seemed so much healthier. I figured I could stop worrying that I was on track to die of lung cancer. But then this happened.
The CDC says there are now more than 2,000 vaping-related cases of lung disease. 39 people have died from lung injuries linked to vaping. The CDC and the FDA are still trying to determine exactly why people are getting sick.
It turns out I had found vaping just before the news came out about E-Valley. That's the name the Centers for Disease Control gave to the mysterious vaping-related illness that was suddenly sweeping across the country. News about it was everywhere. Even my doctor told me I needed to quit vaping, that e-cigarettes were just as bad as smoking, maybe even worse. But it was confusing, because shortly after, I started hearing reports that E-Valley wasn't necessarily tied to e-cigarettes as a whole, but rather to THC products, which made me wonder, were the kinds of e-cigarettes I was vaping, the mainstream kind that you can buy at the shop, really that dangerous? I decided to investigate. So I called up tobacco researcher Mike Spiegel. He's a professor at the Boston University School of Public Health.
There's no evidence whatsoever that e-cigarettes have anything to do with the E-Valley outbreak.
Mike says all the evidence so far points to vitamin E acetate. That's a thickening agent that's only used in THC cartridges, not in nicotine liquids. So that was relief. But what about all this bad news I'd been hearing about E-Valley and vaping in general? Mike says there's been a lot of miscommunication about this issue, and that a lot of it started with the Centers for Disease Control.
From the very beginning, CDC really ignored very strong evidence that this was related to THC products and not to e-cigarettes. And so I think that the language that they used confused a lot of people. As time went on, the CDC finally was forced to admit that, in fact, this was being caused by THC vaping. And you know, the problem, though, is that it took them about 2 months before they finally admitted that, even though the evidence was pretty clear, you know, at least 8 weeks earlier, that this was a THC issue, not a nicotine-related product issue.
But by that time, Mike says the public impression had already been set. And some researchers think the way this was communicated by the CDC, implicating vaping in general, was no accident. Case in point, David Sweener. He leads the Center for Health Law Policy and Ethics at the University of Ottawa.
We've had ideology at places like the CDC being very anti-nicotine or anti any sort of tobacco or vaping product that's taken precedence over the science.
I heard this idea from a couple of different researchers that were in the middle of a kind of moral panic about vaping. And that, more than anything, has clouded the science on e-cigarettes. To be fair, the CDC isn't alone in being concerned about vaping. In recent months, we've seen several research findings about the long-term dangers of vaping. For instance, that it poses a serious threat to our lungs and our hearts. But the Boston University researcher, Mike Spiegel, says based on what he's seen,
the research that is being cited in support of this connection is really not valid, in my opinion, because it didn't control for smoking. It didn't control for the person's history of smoking.
Meaning the bad health effects could very well be the result of years of smoking, not of vaping. Again, David Sweener says, this goes back to a kind of nicotine prohibitionism, which he thinks stems from how hard researchers originally fought against the tobacco industry.
Many of us who got involved in battling those companies, you know, really were in a fight against evil. And one of the challenges in that is continuing to focus on the facts rather than believe that you're in this, simply fighting sin. And I think many of the people who got involved in the field, you know, got so much into a dragon fighter mentality that they were out to destroy evil. And the problem when you do that, if you look at the history of witch hunts and heretic trials, is you keep finding new witches and heretics. You start seeing the problem is ever bigger, and you start closing your mind to anything that might dispute what you're doing.
Most of the researchers I talked to acknowledge that we don't know what the long-term effects of e-cigarettes are. But they said we do know enough to be able to say they're safer than regular cigarettes. One of the reasons we know that is because in the UK, public health authorities have taken a totally different approach to e-cigarettes. Instead of looking at them as a threat, they've treated them as a tool for harm reduction. They regulated them, did research on them. They've even officially promoted them to the public as a safe and effective way of quitting smoking. So far, they say e-cigarettes have helped an estimated 50,000 people in the UK to quit. And here's the kicker. All with no signs of E-Valley. In the U.S., some tobacco researchers worry we're shutting the door on using vaping as a tool to reduce smoking. One of them is Kenneth Warner.
the health authorities in Great Britain have concluded that vaping is at least 95% less dangerous than cigarette smoking. I don't think we know that, but I do believe that we can confidently say that vaping is substantially less dangerous than cigarette smoking. Unfortunately, the public doesn't understand that. They have been misled to think quite the contrary.
Kenneth says his biggest concern is that publicity surrounding e-Valley could stop people from vaping, sending them back into the arms of cigarettes.
And that would be a public health tragedy.
It's not just theoretical. It's actually what happened to me. After all the news about the dangers of vaping, I decided to stop. But I wasn't ready to quit nicotine cold turkey. So instead, I bought a pack of Camels.
So now I'm standing outside having my first cigarette in probably a couple months.
To be honest, it was depressing. I thought I'd gotten this monkey off my back. And here I was, back to square one. But after talking to all these researchers, I changed my mind again. The big takeaway for me is that harm reduction is worth it. Vaping might not be great for my lungs and body, but it's almost certainly better than smoking. And that's true on a broader level, too. Kenneth Warner did a study in which he used a simulation model that envisions what the impacts of vaping would be, good and bad, over 50 years.
And in doing this, we discovered that pretty much any assumptions that you use, you would end up with a net benefit, more life years saved than lost, with vaping than without it.
For me, all of this came as a big relief. In the end, I decided to stick it out with Juul. So that's where I am now, still vaping. The next step is to try and slowly wean myself off nicotine. At least, that's the plan. We'll see how it goes.
That was Liz Tung reporting. We reached out to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for comment, and here's what we got back. It came from Brian King, the chief science officer. Quote, "It is CDC's goal and priority to provide the American public with data-driven and science-based recommendations related to the investigation of e-cigarette or vaping product use-associated lung injury. We are a data-driven agency, and we remain committed to basing our recommendations on facts and science." We're talking about new problems and how to tackle them. Asthma is on the rise across the U.S., and the problem is especially bad on reservations. There, kids with asthma are more likely to get attacks and more likely to die from the condition. And emergency rooms are far away. It often takes a medevac plane to get there. Reporter Eilish O'Neill visited the Navajo Nation, a reservation in northeast Arizona, and she has this report.
The Navajo Reservation is a vast desert landscape the size of West Virginia. It's dry, dusty, and windy. It's bitterly cold in the winter. Rock formations and red and brown dirt stretch for miles, dotted with sparse shrubs. It takes hours to drive between towns, and there can be miles between houses. Many roads are unpaved, and hardly anyone has an address.
Mom, wasn't mine was 9? They got me
eight. Oh, no, your shoes ain't even circled.
Chelsea Holtzoy lives there with the 5 of her children who still live at home.
Oh, same as yours.
The evening I visited, Chelsea had a box of pants, jackets, and shoes that the Navajo Nation had given her for her kids.
Yeah, it's a nice jacket. Awesome. Got the right size.
They don't have indoor plumbing or central heating. There's an outhouse 50 yards away on the field of hard-packed dirt where their cabin sits. Chelsea's son, Ethan, is 10. He likes playing football with his friends, and his favorite subject at school is math. He and his siblings live close enough to school that they walk there, through a hole in a fence and across a field. When he was a little guy, Ethan was really sick. Once, when he was 3 years old, he got a terrible fever.
Oh, he's burning up, you know. I start getting scared. Ice water we got. We put a rag in it, we wrung it out. We're just wiping his body down. Pretty soon the water was warm from just wiping him down.
When the ice water didn't help, Chelsea gave her son ibuprofen, but she says his temperature just kept going up and up.
It's really a scary experience, especially when they're that small. It just hurt just looking at him.
Chelsea rushed him to the nearest clinic. There, the doctors told her Ethan didn't just have a fever. He was having an asthma attack, and his oxygen levels were alarmingly low. They wanted to send him to an intensive care unit in Phoenix, which would be a five-hour drive. So Chelsea and Ethan boarded a medevac plane, and they went.
All right, before takeoff, we have our dispatch number. Doors are closed. Pressure, temperature.
I just kept looking at him. I was scared, and I just kept praying and praying and praying when we're in the plane. No parent should ever experience that.
Ethan had to spend about a week in the ICU before he was well enough to leave. Asthma is getting worse across the U.S. Since the 1980s, it's been increasing across all ages and ethnic groups. But it's a bigger problem among Native Americans. People living on the Navajo Reservation, for example, are 1.5 times as likely to have asthma as people living elsewhere in the U.S.
The environmental exposures here are impossible to control.
Diana Hu is a pediatrician who's been working on the Navajo Reservation for 35 years. She says some of the causes of asthma on the reservation are old.
We have, you know, Russian thistles or, you know, tumbleweeds everywhere. We have elms everywhere. We have cottonwoods everywhere.
Those are all plants that can set off kids' allergies, which can trigger an asthma attack. There's some evidence that climate change is increasing the amount of pollen in the air, which some researchers say is contributing to the rise of asthma. Other factors that contribute to asthma are new. There are fossil fuel projects like coal mines on the Navajo Reservation. Air pollution from coal mines is associated with increased asthma. And then there are daily 1 to 2 hour drives on diesel school buses from far-flung houses to the towns where the schools are. Diesel fumes can both cause and exacerbate asthma. And there's something else.
We always had a wood stove. That's one thing I didn't really want to use as a heating source, but that's all we could afford.
That's Chelsea again. Like 65% of families here, she heats her house with a wood stove.
Cover your mouth.
It's black, with a little door for putting wood in and a wide stovepipe coming out of the back. It has no filter to keep smoke and ash out of the cabin the way more expensive wood stoves do. Chelsea says wood costs her $100 for a truckload. Wood pellets burn cleaner, but would cost $20 for a small bag. Chelsea says she can't even consider electric heat, though she wishes she could. When it's smoky, it triggers Ethan's asthma.
He gets really mucousy. It's like boogers. And like you can hear it. You can hear those boogers and he'll try to spit it out. And it sounds congested.
To try to keep him healthy, Chelsea makes sure the stovepipe is always clean so smoke won't blow back into the cabin. And she always has a pot of water on the stove so there's steam in the air.
The doctors told us make sure you always have a pot of water to keep the air kind of humid. For them, not dry.
When federal agencies like the CDC have tried to help lower asthma rates on reservations, the efforts have often been met with resistance. That's why, on some reservations, researchers and healthcare providers are trying new community-based approaches.
Our main goal is to really educate the Navajo Nation, even especially with the hospital staff and also the schools.
There's a program run by the University of Arizona working on community asthma education. Stevic Jim is the project manager.
We want to educate. This is what asthma is. These are what triggers are before it gets to that extreme level.
Jim says educating the community has been challenging. For one thing, asthma is still such a new problem on the reservation. There isn't even a word in Navajo for asthma, so it's hard to explain to grandparents, who are often the caretakers, that it's a chronic condition that needs regular medication. Jim says his goal is prevention. Teaching caregivers how to help avoid medical crises.
14.
Ethan's 10 years old now, and he's doing better. Ethan and one of his brothers were sitting next to their mom eating chips when she told me the doctors put him on a new medication and he hasn't been to the emergency room since.
He's been doing pretty good in PE and stuff. And I usually tell them, like, if you're going to go running, make sure he takes a puff before he does his workouts.
Mom.
So just to make sure he
plays football and tackle.
I just want him to get better.
That story was reported by Eilish O'Neill. for talking about new problems today. And by the way, you can find the show wherever you get your podcasts. Wood burning is a driver of air pollution all over the world.
That's a big problem in a lot of places like India and Africa, where people rely on wood and other really smoky fuels like dung to cook their meals. But what was most surprising to me about that is that it's actually really a danger to us in wealthier nations as well.
That's Beth Gardner. She's a journalist and the author of Choked: Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution.
People are increasingly, I think, burning wood at home, and whether it's, you know, fireplaces or these sort of more upscale kind of log burning stoves, there's an idea that it's, you know, kind of natural, and, you know, there's something obviously wonderful and cozy about a fire in a fireplace. And I think that's part of why it took me a long time, even in researching this book, to actually understand that wood smoke is very thick with a lot of toxins, and particularly these tiny pollution particles that are very dangerous because they penetrate deep into our bodies and our bloodstreams.
Fossil fuels are, of course, a huge culprit as well. The World Health Organization estimates that 90% of people, 90%, breathe unhealthy air.
So whether it's, you know, the gasoline that we put in our cars or the coal that gets burned in power plants, it's putting a taint into our air that is really making people sick.
And it's not just our lungs that are suffering.
It's very clearly understood now, and there's a really vast and growing body of scientific evidence that links particle pollution to what I found to be a really jaw-dropping list of illnesses, whether it's heart attacks and strokes or dementia and premature birth, and research moving on now to connections with things like diabetes and obesity. It's believed by scientists that these particles are tiny enough to cross from our lungs into our bloodstream.
You traveled a lot in writing this book, and I'm wondering what air pollution can look like at its worst, when it is truly visible, and what that's like for the residents.
So China is, you know, still struggling with a really serious air pollution problem, but they are actually making some progress in cleaning it up. The place that I think has, you know, really almost the worst air on earth, and I've framed it in the book as kind of the ground zero of air pollution, is India and South Asia more broadly. And I went to Delhi, and you can really see, and I was there at a relatively clean time of year even, but you could sort of look up in the evening and see this sort of smoky haze shimmering in the streetlights and buildings, you know, only visible in outline, even, you know, only 100 yards away, because they were sort of shrouded by this haze. One of the things that really sort of blew me away was there's actually air pollution in Delhi that can be photographed from space by NASA because the smoke is so thick. And the human impact of that is apocalyptic almost. You know, you have hospitals filled with wheezing kids and people struggling for breath. And it's really become a very, very powerful driver of illness and death in Delhi. And it's shaping people's lives.
It seems like this problem in some places around the world will reach a point where something has to be done. Is that what it takes? Because I feel like we have some of these issues here, but they're not quite as visible. So it's probably a slower process.
Well, that's something that's happened in China. You know, I think over the past sort of 6 or 8 or 10 years, there's been a real growing understanding among the population there of how much air pollution was affecting their health. And people began to get very angry. And that was when the government of China actually made a decision that this was something that they really needed to deal with. And they've started taking steps like investing in renewable energy and electric cars and things like that, that have started to bring the pollution down. And it was, I think, very much a response to public anger. And interestingly, I think that's what really happened with the United States back in the late sort of 1960s and the early 1970s, and helped to bring about our Clean Air Act, the Clean Air Act of 1970, which has delivered, you know, such tremendous progress over the past almost 50 years in cleaning up America's air. But I think we've sort of lost that urgency around it because it is so much better than it once was.
What are some things you saw around the world that gave you hope, where something good happened?
I went to Poland, which is one of the worst polluted countries in Europe. It's very, very heavily dependent on coal. And one of their biggest problems is people burning coal at home for heat. It's very, very highly polluting. And you see these really thick plumes of black smoke coming out of people's chimneys. In the city of Krakow, there was really, through grassroots activism, this movement of parents and people who were, you know, really angry and upset about what this was doing to their health. And, you know, after months and months of protests and online activism and all of that, they actually ended up winning a ban by the regional legislature of coal burning at home in the city of Krakow. So Poland as a whole is still very, you know, badly polluted and very dependent on coal. But this is sort of a beacon of hope and I think a symbol of what individuals can achieve when they try to bring some change in the world.
Beth Gardner is the author of Choked, Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about new problems and some potential solutions. It's hard to remember a time before social media, YouTube, and our frequent exchanges with total strangers. This has given rise to a new problem: online harassment. It's happened to about 4 in 10 Americans. This could be anything from being called names or somebody posting something embarrassing about you to physical threats and stalking. It can be especially tough for people who have to have a strong online presence for their work. Some of them are turning to therapists for help. The problem is, what can therapists really do about this? Alan Yu reports.
Lindsay Ellis has a YouTube channel. She comments on films, TV shows, and other media. Here she is talking about recent Disney remakes.
The tendency to self-correct the outdated or questionable morality of the source material is all over the place in these remakes. Dumbo, in particular, is rife with it. See, in the original film, Dumbo accidentally gets lit on some champagne and hallucinates.
You can hear her analysis and see the scenes she's talking about.
But here...
Champagne for Dumbo!
No booze near the baby!
No, we couldn't allow underage elephants to drink. What would the children think?
And she's popular. Lindsay has more than 850,000 subscribers and more than 7,000 people who pledge to fund her work every month. But there is a difficult aspect to her work: online hate. It started from day one.
Usually it was very benign, like, you know, try to diminish what you do by, like, you know, making comments about your appearance or even stranger ones saying, like, well, if they thought what I had to say was interesting, they would assume that a man was writing it.
At first, she would collect the ones she thought were funny, but she stopped doing that pretty quickly.
I guess anyone, but women especially, that has any kind of online presence, they all have a stalker story.
Hers happened in 2013. This particular stalker targeted Lindsay and a bunch of other female content creators.
Well, he was a burp fetishist. He would just flood everyone's mentions with requests for, like, burp for me.
And yes, she knows this sounds ridiculous and kind of funny. Most of the people she told were bemused to hear about someone wanting to hear her burp.
And this went on for several months, and I think whenever everyone started blocking him, that's when he kind of started to turn violent, or at least his rhetoric started to turn violent. You know, I'm going to rape you, like my friend had just had a baby at the time, like I'm going to kill your baby.
At the time, Lindsay and the other women were all in New York. They figured out this guy is probably local, so they printed out as much evidence as they could and went to the police.
We got the local detectives involved, and effectively they said, yes, this is an arrestable offense, but it's a misdemeanor, so we can't break into his house, even though we know where he lives and he has a record, which was very illustrative in just learning how not just impotent law enforcement is, but how much it's not really a priority for them. And in that case, that was just the beginning in terms of... my harassment journey, because it only got worse from there.
In 2017, she tweeted a joke about the conspiracy theory of white genocide, the idea that somehow white people are being threatened. That made her a target for far-right activists who flooded her with comments.
The knowledge that there are, you know, so many white supremacists out there that know who you are and wish you ill, and, you know, the fact that you are being made to think about this, you know, it affects your brain in a way that, like, any terrifying thing does. Like, fear messes with your brain, especially when it's sustained over a period of weeks and months like this was.
She tried to find help from therapists, but
generally, therapists don't really know what to do with it, so they just kind of tend to ignore it in favor of discussing other things. And it's not like the other things are not relevant whenever you're going through therapy, but every therapist I've ever been to, this particular issue that occupies so much of my daily existence is a really big blind spot for them.
Some therapists have suggested she just log off and stop being online.
It's not only saying, why don't you cut off like half of your social contacts? It's basically saying, like, why don't you quit and do something else? And that doesn't read like a solution to me.
This is her livelihood. The internet lets individual people become online brands.
It is kind of like being a corporation, but where a corporation will have like social media managers and HR and PR teams and marketing, we only have ourselves. And in my case, one lonely assistant that has to moderate. And I think that people are so used to dealing with corporations and brands, they don't understand that. And they don't understand that they're not dealing with a corporation. They're dealing with a person.
Therapists and psychologists have studied cyberbullying for years, but there isn't much research on how to help the victims.
That's a huge deficit that needs to be filled.
Robin Kowalski is a psychologist at Clemson University. She studies bullying and cyberbullying. She says most of the cyberbullying research is on kids, and only recently moved to look at online harassment among adults. Which means that if a therapist or mental health professional has a client who is being harassed online and wants to know how to help them, that research doesn't really exist yet.
Where that leaves mental health professionals is dealing with the anxiety and the depression and the suicidal ideation and the job dissatisfaction that we know are outcomes.
Catherine Stamoulis is an educational psychologist. She has helped clients with online harassment, like teenage girls who get harassed by peers or by ex-boyfriends. But this is a problem for people beyond teenagers and people who make their living online. Catherine says that while there might not be specific treatment guidelines about online harassment, she helps her clients by drawing on techniques for dealing with similar issues like sexual harassment and bullying.
The field knows that this is a problem. Research is coming out. But as of yet, we don't have anything that's, you know, saying this is the best therapeutic strategy to deal with it.
This year, she's leading a subgroup of the American Psychological Association that focuses on media and technology. Their group is writing guidelines to help therapists treat victims of online abuse. For now, Lindsay still sees her therapist, but she also gets support from her peers. Some of her close friends also make a living online and face the same problem.
We just talk about how, like, afraid we are and how we have to meter everything we say and how everything is optics and, you know, your lived experience does not matter. The only thing that matters is trying to cultivate an online brand that will mitigate the harassment and will just make them calm down. The only thing we can really do is just sort of vent because, you know, we don't really have any solutions and it's incredibly isolating.
That story was reported by Alan Yu. We're talking about new problems, and coming up, electronic health records were supposed to make things easier, but
doctors routinely say, you know, I went to medical school to deal with patients, not to deal with the screen.
Electronic medical records are a blessing and a curse. They have significantly altered the interpersonal dynamic in the exam room. Eye contact is really diminished, and I hate that part.
That's still to come on The Pulse.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. Life sciences talent is coming to Greater Philadelphia to study, live, and work in its leading universities, laboratories, startups, and tech companies. More at discoverystartshere.com.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about new problems that we're grappling with and what can be done about them. Researcher Samuel Murray is fascinated by distractions and the mistakes we make as a result.
One example that I like to give is the guy who's in the grocery store with his three kids. Father was bagging groceries, you know, made the payment, took the groceries, and then started to walk out of the store, at which point his two kids said, "Are we just going to leave the third kid behind?" and the dad sort of realized, like, oh, right, turned around and went back and got the kid out of the shopping cart. And I know that story because that was my dad.
Samuel is a postdoctoral researcher at Duke University.
I think he bought us donuts. He was like, you know, Mom doesn't need to know what happened. And first thing we did when we got back was say, "Mom, guess what happened at the grocery store?"
Yeah, of course. It seems like we're just not made for doing several things at once.
We have very limited bodies, so we can only move in one direction in space. We can only speak one word at a time. So there are some things that our minds can't do. And despite all of those limitations of both body and mind, we have this capacity to formulate huge, vast numbers of goals that often stretch over these long timescales. So, you know, I'm planning to take a trip to Turkey in a couple months and planning to see my family later this year, in addition to doing a bunch of other things later today.
Samuel and his research partner, Santiago Amaya, study multitasking, distractions, and mistakes. These days, it's hard to work on one task without being constantly reminded of something else that needs to be done right now. Here's Santiago. He joined us via Skype from Bogota.
And our phones and our computers are these gateways into other projects that are happening while we are doing other things. So your email beeps or your phone rings, many different things that are going on.
And in between tasks, we check our social media accounts, which Samuel says is an infinite rabbit hole.
Usually when people go on, they just scroll through Facebook or Instagram or Twitter, and you can always keep scrolling. There's no point at which you've done a good amount of scrolling.
Right.
That's one of the things that makes social media and technology very distracting is it pulls you in and there's nothing that makes you recognize, like, now I'm done with this and can move on to something else or move back to something else.
So with all of these things happening at once, our brains are on overload. And that leads to mistakes, says Santiago.
Because we're doing too many things at the same time, we run the risk of making mistakes while doing some of those things. Especially when it comes to things that we do very often, things that are habitual, things that we can do on autopilot.
We think we can do them on autopilot, but it's a trap. Santiago and Samuel have found that mistakes are related to the difficulty of the task.
We know that when tasks are very complicated, we tend to make mistakes. But one of the things that we've been noticing is that as tasks get really, really simple, everyday tasks, also the likelihood of mistakes go up. So if you're facing some new task, something that requires some expertise, you know that you can make some mistakes and you take some precautions for that.
And Samuel, what have you learned about? What are some things we could do to avoid mistakes?
So simply knowing about this susceptibility that people have to being overconfident can help serve as a corrective.
And why do you think, I don't know if either one of you has a guess on this, but the thought of multitasking is very seductive. And even though, like, I'm fully aware that I cannot multitask, I still try it all the time. And I think, oh, yeah, I can look at this real quick and listen to this other thing. And it's nonsense. But it seems like we should be able to do that, right?
So it turns out that Being able to multitask requires a much more complicated brain setup, and it would require a much larger brain that can do lots of things simultaneously, but ends up being very inefficient. We can build Apple Watches that have four circuits that can multitask like crazy. And the human brain, which has, you know, trillions of neurons, can't do what a simple Apple Watch does. But it turns out that our brains can do much more sophisticated things than an Apple Watch because we trade off efficiency for multitasking.
Samuel Murray is a postdoctoral researcher in psychology at Duke University. Santiago Amaya is an associate professor of philosophy at Universidad de los Andes in Bogota. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about new problems. A lot of healthcare professionals say they are being forced to multitask, and it's hurting their patients. They're talking about electronic health records, or EHRs, the record-keeping system that most American hospitals use. They were supposed to revolutionize medicine, make it way easier to share and manage patient info. But right now, they seem clunky and hard to use.
I cannot type and talk. It's just impossible for me.
A Stanford University survey found that 6 out of 10 primary care doctors said that electronic health records need a complete overhaul. What would that overhaul look like? Camille Peterson reports.
Checking the pulses with the machine, okay.
At your latest checkup, you may have noticed that your doctor spent more time looking at a computer screen than at you.
You don't have any pain anywhere at all, do you?
No.
No. Okay.
You can partly blame electronic health records, the medical software many clinicians despise. Noemi El-Haddad is a computer scientist at Columbia Medical School, and she gets why clinicians are so frustrated by this software. Every single move requires a lot of clicks.
And so a simple task of prescribing a medication can become, several minutes long. Basically, physicians and clinicians as a whole are spending more time dealing with the software than actually interacting with a patient.
And even though there's all this data and information in electronic health records, Noemi says most doctors and nurses can't really use it to treat their patients. To explain, she pulls up a sample record with a long list of notes about operations the patient had.
Unless you click on each note and read, you wouldn't know what the operation is about or anything like that.
So doctors can see that you had an operation in May of last year, but to see what it was, they have to open the note and read it. There is no summary. Noemi's software focuses on digging out all that buried information.
So we have a test patient called Carmen San Diego.
Noemi's program uses natural language processing, a type of machine learning, to take information from the notes and reorganize it into an interactive visualization. It's like a story about the patient. So Carmen San Diego's record has 3 parts. At the top, there's a timeline of her 5 years as a patient.
And on the timeline, you can expand or zoom in or zoom out.
In the middle, there's a word cloud,
which is basically all the problems that have been extracted from the documentation of that patient for that particular selected time span. And as you move through the timeline, it can show you all the different problems and how they change. Here I'm focusing on leukemia.
So the doctor could zoom in and look at different complications that went along with Carmen's leukemia, what medication she was given, and so on. At the bottom, you can see the full narrative of this medical problem.
We can get all the documentation for that problem and get a better understanding of it.
Noemi says about 10,000 clinicians at New York Presbyterian Hospital are using her software. And it's like an app that's compatible with the big electronic health record system the hospital already has. And that's important.
Once a hospital invests in an EHR, there's no room for buyer's remorse.
That's Ross Capel. He's a sociologist at the University of Pennsylvania. He's studied electronic health records since their rollout in the late 90s. And he says these days, a few big companies control the market for hospitals, so there's not a lot of competition. Plus,
if you spend a couple of $100 million, or even in the case of a large hospital system, up to $2 billion on buying and implementing an EHR, you're not about to say, oh, golly gee, we got the wrong system. It's a massive investment. You're married to the mob.
That makes it really hard to just scrap a system if doctors and nurses don't like it. So Ross thinks the smaller hospital-by-hospital solutions are crucial. But
it's sort of silly. It's like you buy a car and then you have to buy an extra steering wheel and seats.
He says ultimately we'll have to change the way we regulate electronic health records to make sure the big systems are easy to use and focused on patient safety.
We have this free zone. It's Wild West.
If these digital records worked better, they could lead to better patient care.
What's your sort of dream world look like?
My sort of dream world.
Ken Ricciato is a clinical informatics researcher at Columbia Nursing School. But before that, he was an oncology nurse, so he really knows both computer science and medicine. He's trying to get electronic health record data to live up to its potential. When Kenrick started digging into huge amounts of this data, he noticed something.
When a nurse is concerned about a patient, the nurse starts doing more observations, putting more information into the EHR about that patient. And that happens long before you see any physiological changes.
Before a patient's heart rate or temperature or blood pressure changes, nurses know. But nobody, including them, really knows that they know, which is why the electronic health record is so revealing.
We can detect patterns that would have been very difficult to detect before, first to even discover them, but then to detect them in the real-time settings.
Kenrick built a predictive model that scans all the nurses' observations in the records. His model is as accurate as other patient warning scores, and it's faster.
Our score, because we have this nursing expertise, fires earlier, sometimes 24 to 48 hours earlier than other early warning scores.
He's monitoring how this predictive system performs in two hospitals, in New York City and in Boston. He thinks it'll reduce patient mortality and change how clinicians communicate.
They can see, the model is saying that a nurse might be more concerned about this patient, and it'll cause them to prioritize reaching out to the nurse and saying, oh, I see that, you're worrying about this patient's deterioration. Can you tell me why?
Kenrick knows the kind of research he and Noemi are doing is slow, and they're not overhauling a system that many clinicians hate. But remember, electronic health records are still new.
Yeah, we're in the teenage years.
I don't know what that means. It seems like tumultuous times, I guess, yes, right?
Exactly. Yeah, tumultuous stuff going on. And just, learning, basically.
That story was reported by Camille Peterson.
Yeah, I'm out that paper. No more chasing med records. Writing so illegible that I'll be hip up forever. Bought the new software, and though we use it here, I can't use it over there. Different systems everywhere. I used to chart on paper. All of my verbals recorded, mixed up with the ward clerk. Turned diluted to dilaudid.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jad Slayman, and Steph Yin. We had production assistance from Julian Harris. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.